Today on Against the Grain, radiation is a fearsome thing. It occurs naturally and very unnaturally, and is used both as a medical treatment and a terrifying weapon. Timothy Jorgensen has traced the history of how scientists became aware of radiation's dangers to the human body, from the so-called radium girls, factory workers who were poisoned painting watch dials, to the horrors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the hydrogen bomb experiments in the Bikini Atoll, and Chernobyl and Fukushima. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The utility company that operates the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan has announced that radiation levels from one of the reactors that melted down in 2011 are astoundingly high, way higher than what was measured at the time of the Fukushima meltdown. It may be that such levels have been unmeasured until now, but it illustrates the continuing dangers of radiation itself. Timothy Jorgensen believes that, rather than leaving things to experts, people should inform themselves about the greater and lesser risks of radiation. He's associate professor of radiation medicine and director of the Health Physics and Radiation Protection Graduate Program at Georgetown University. He's written a book on the matter, which is titled Strange Glow, The Story of Radiation, and it's published by Princeton University Press. When I spoke with him recently, I asked him to talk about when radiation's harmful effects on the human body were first discovered.
So radiation's health effects were discovered very shortly after it was discovered. And it was discovered, X-rays were discovered in 1895. And the people who were working with X-rays, primarily physicists at the time, noted that their hands were getting burned when they were working with X-ray beams. And that was the first indication that X-rays could do something harmful to the body. So shortly after that, people who were grossly overexposed started getting big sores on their hands. A few years later, it was discovered that places where these sores appeared, some of them ultimately developed into cancers. So it wasn't very long after radiation was discovered that it was known that it could damage tissues and produce cancer.
And what were the initial theories about how radiation did the damage that it did?
Well, it wasn't clear at all early on how radiation damaged things. It was this mysterious type of ray. In fact, that's why it was originally called an X-ray, because they didn't know anything about it. But soon after that, people discovered that when radiation passed through things, it also left some energy in what it passed through, namely tissues. And if it left too much energy, it could actually damage the tissue by burning it. We now know that the most serious type of damage is damage that it does to DNA, because that's the type of damage that can go on to produce cancer. But it was much longer after that before we understood some of these mechanisms. So basically what people did, they just kept the doses low enough so they didn't see any visible burning on their skin. And as long as they didn't see anything visible like that, they considered that to be a safe dose of radiation.
So they didn't really have a notion of the longer term effects that radiation might do if the acute effects were kept under control.
No, in fact, they thought all of radiation's effects were reversible. So, for example, they thought that if you burned your hands, you could just stop working with radiation for a while. As soon as the burn was gone, you could resume and you were back to square one. Soon after that, they found out that not just skin, but you could also get lower blood counts from being exposed to radiation. But again, they thought if you stopped working and your blood counts returned to normal, you essentially were back to ground zero and you could continue working. So that's the way people work with it. They didn't appreciate that there was any kind of cumulative damage. They thought it was a temporary sort of damage that fixed itself, and it wasn't much to worry about, since they could obviously see that there was a reversal of this damage.
Obviously, today, radiation, and through the 20th century, has conjured a great amount of fear in the general public. How did the general public react to radiation in the early days, to the extent they were aware of it?
Well, shortly after X-rays were discovered, radioactivity was discovered. And radioactivity is actually radiation that comes from the disintegration of atoms. And so the first radioactive elements discovered were discovered by the Curies. They discovered radium and polonium. And radium actually fascinated people. It was this idea that a substance could emit energy was very appealing, and people could see what radium was doing, because in the early days they used to mix radium with fluorescent paint and use it to illuminate things. And there was a famous case where radium dial painters would paint the dials of watches with this fluorescent radium impregnated paint. And when you turned off the lights in the room, the dial would glow in the dark. Now, I know that today we have fluorescent dials that glow in the dark, but they work by a different principle. Basically, they absorb visible light, and then when you turn off the light, they give it back. But these dials didn't require any light exposure. It was the radium itself, the radioactivity itself, that caused the dials to illuminate. And these were very hot items. These were the iPhones of the day. Everybody wanted one of these. And ironically, though, shortly after that, it turned out that the women who painted these dials were coming down with all kinds of bizarre bone diseases. And it was ultimately traced to the fact that they were eating the radium. The reason they were eating the radium is because they used to paint the watch dials with paintbrushes, and the brushes would get blunted, as you would expect. And so they would twist the edge of the brush in the corner of their mouth to point the brush. And in doing so, they ingested a little bit of paint, and over a course of a year, they had ingested a considerable amount of radium paint. And radium, chemically, is very similar to calcium, and our bones are made of calcium. So the radium went right to our bones. Our bodies mistook the radium for calcium, and in the bones, the radium delivered a whopping dose to these women, and they came down with terrible bone necroses and bone cancers and things like that. And this was widely publicized, and that was the first time that the public became acutely aware that eating radioactivity was not good at all. So that was a major turning point in the public's attitude about the safety of radiation and radioactivity.
Were there any consequences to public health of people wearing these watches? I mean, clearly, as you write in the book, workers tend to be the canaries in the coal mine for any kind of environmental health exposure, since they'll have it in the highest doses. But was there any way to track whether those people who wore these watches had any effects from the radium painted on them?
Well, inside the watch, the radium is contained inside the watch, and so there's very little radiation that escaped from the watch. The real danger from the watches was actually ingesting the radium. So since the customers didn't eat the watches or any part of the watches, they were really not at risk. It was the people who made the watches that were at risk. But an interesting side point to that is that some people believe that radium, because it emitted energy, would be beneficial to health. And so they basically put radium in health drinks. And so these types of health drinks were pretty popular at the time. And there were some notable examples of people eating huge quantities of this, and they came down with symptoms similar to the radium watch dial painters. So, and it's a shame because, like I said, the scientists knew that radium went to bone. They suspected that there was these problems, but there wasn't any FDA or anything like that at the time, and all kinds of charlatans made up stories about what radium could do for you, and were putting it in all types of products, and the public did suffer some from these scams.
Well, speaking of regulation, to what degree after the fallout, which became quite public, of the poisoning with radium of the women who painted the radium dials of the watches, to what degree did that growing awareness of the dangers of radiation lead to regulation from the state? And how did that regulation change with time as the awareness of radiation's dangers changed?
Well, as people became aware that radiation could be harmful, there was great interest in determining a safe dose. So it's the dose that determines how much risk is involved. And you couldn't abolish radiation and radioactivity from society. It had already become essential. So X-rays, I'd just like to mention that very shortly after X-rays were discovered, within a month or so, they were used in to make diagnostic X-rays. And within a month or so, they were also used to treat cancer and successfully. So tumors were being shrunk with the use of X-rays. And so no one wanted to go back to no X-rays. The issue was how much radiation could be sustained and still not have any danger involved. At the time, there was this idea that, as I've already mentioned, that things could be reversible. And so that there was the initial standards had to do with reddening of skin. So if you had enough radiation that it reddened your skin, that was considered too much, and so they would back off to a dose that would not redden skin. And it was believed that as long as you didn't have visible effects like that, you were in the clear. So that was the basis. It was called an erythema dose. So that was the basis for the first standards, an erythema dose, to keep things below a dose that would cause irritation to the skin. In terms of ingesting radioactivity, that was more difficult. A lot of the data from the radium dial painters was examined by numerous scientific committees, and eventually they came up with it's interesting because the scientific committee, which was, of course, at the time composed of all men, they came up with the wife or daughter criteria. Basically, they asked the committee members to decide which level, based on the data, which level of radioactivity they would feel safe with their wife or daughter eating. So that was hardly a scientific criteria, but that was supposed to be, by putting it in terms of someone that was near and dear to the scientist, that was supposedly going to give the highest level of protection. So the initial standards were based on that. Later on, as we became better able at quantitating doses and as the mechanism of radiation damage to cells and tissues became apparent, we came up with more scientific rationales based on acceptable levels of risk. But in the early days, it was quite difficult to come up with these standards.
Well, Timothy Jorgensen, as you write in your book, Strange Glow, The Story of Radiation, with time, scientists realize that different types of radiation have different deleterious health effects, and that the place of the body that one is exposed to radiation has a lot to do with the level of risk of developing illness. Starting with the first one, the varied effects of different types of radiation, can you explain to us why all forms of radiation are not equal in terms of effects on the body?
Yeah, so the biggest divide between types of radiation are the ionizing and the non-ionizing radiation. So you can think of it this way. As radiation energies increase, they get to the point that that the energy is sufficient enough that it can actually break chemical bonds. And in doing that, they produce ions. And so at this level of energy, anything higher than that, we have a lot of damage to molecules, all types of molecules, including biological molecules. And we call radiations with this high level of energy ionizing radiations because they ionize molecules. And that would be things like X-rays, gamma rays, things like that. Below this, radiations don't have enough energy to break chemical bonds. And we think that breaking chemical bonds is necessary for to have biological effects. So these types of radiations, they don't have enough energy to break chemical bonds, so it's unclear how, if any, these types of radiations could have biological effects.
What about the place of exposure in the body, and what effect does that have? To what degree does that limit or broaden the danger that radiation poses to our health?
Well, We talk about whole body exposures. That's where every tissue of the body is exposed. And then we talk about partial body exposures, where only certain tissues are exposed. And I've already alluded to that about the when I talked about the radium dial painters. Because radium mimics calcium in its chemistry, this radioactivity went exclusively to their bones. So the bones are getting the entire dose from the radioactivity. And the problem with bones is that inside your bones is your bone marrow. And so in addition to the bone cells themselves being irradiated, marrow produces blood. So if you irradiate the skeleton, the bones, you also are going to have an effect on bone development, but also you're going to have an effect on blood formation. And so this is the scenario with partial body exposures like that, that you're going to get a specific effect that's related to the tissues that are being exposed. Other sensitive tissues in the body, for example, are the thyroid gland. So the thyroid gland is of concern because it can, as part of its normal function, it concentrates iodine. And so if that iodine happens to be radioactive, as iodine-131 is, then you will have a big concentration of radioactivity in your thyroid gland, and consequently a high thyroid dose, and consequently an increased risk of thyroid cancer. So other parts of the body that are more sensitive are anything where cells are replicating very quickly. So that's why people, if they have a radiation therapy to their head, their hair will fall out because the hair follicle cells are killed. If you have radiation to your gut, there are rapidly growing cells that are within your small intestines, and they are damaged by the radiation because cells that are rapidly dividing tend to be vulnerable to radiation. So the exact organ and tissue that's irradiated is going to be a large determinant about as to what types of health effects you're going to see.
But to be clear, so when you're talking about the risk that parts of your body might suffer from radiation, for you to have an elevated risk of thyroid cancer, you're not saying that specifically the thyroid was exposed to the radiation. You're saying that the kind of form of radiation that maybe one ingested or breathed in particularly was receptive, say, it contained iodine to that particular organ. Is that right?
So I'm saying two things. First of all, for the organ to be damaged by radiation, the organ has to have been exposed to some radiation dose. And that radiation dose, if it relates to ingesting radioactivity, will be largely determined by the fate of that radioactivity in the body. And different types of radioactivity tend to go to different organs. So if you expose your foot, you're not going to get thyroid cancer because the thyroid itself has to be exposed. So how could it be exposed? It could be exposed because you had an X-ray of your thyroid, or it could be exposed because you somehow ingested radioactive iodine. But the dose has to be delivered to the thyroid for the thyroid to be at risk. So that's the fundamental principle, that the organ has to have been exposed to a certain dose, and in order to be at risk, and the risk level is dependent upon the dose level. So if you double the dose, you double the risk.
Molecular radiation biologist Timothy Jorgensen is my guest. He is the author of Strange Glow, The Story of Radiation, which is published by Princeton University Press. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I'd like to ask you about radiation as a cancer treatment and the origins of using radiation therapy. Clearly, as you've mentioned already, there was a growing awareness that radiation could seriously damage or kill off the cells or mutate the cells of the body. How did radiation therapy then emerge, given that earlier conclusion of the dangers of radiation?
Well, this is actually quite a fascinating story in that as soon as X-rays were discovered, within a couple of weeks they were used in therapy. And the reason for this is that X-rays were discovered as coming from something called a Crookes tube. And I really can't get into the details of a Crookes tube here, but it was something that physicists had. It looked like a light bulb. And when you put large high voltages across it, it glowed in the dark. And physicists were trying to figure out why that was happening. And through an accident of fate, one scientist, Wilhelm Röntgen in Germany, he discovered that there was something coming out of these tubes that could move through matter. And when he held his hand up to block these invisible things, he saw the shadows of his bones on a fluorescent screen. And so this is what prompted him to publish. Well, these Crookes tubes were all over the world. All physicists were playing with these Crookes tubes trying to figure out how they worked. In fact, it ended up two Nobel Prizes were awarded for work done on Crookes tubes. But it turns out, just coincidentally, that there was a medical student in Chicago who was working in a Crookes tube factory to pay for his way through medical school. And he noticed, when he worked with these Crookes tubes, that his hands got burned, just as I said earlier, that the X-rays tended to burn hands. And he immediately concluded that his hands were being burned by the X-rays as soon as he found out about Röntgen's discovery. He said, oh, the X-rays must be burning my hands. So when he went to school the next day, he told this to his professors, and they said, well, if X-rays can burn normal tissue, perhaps we can use them to burn out cancerous tumors. So the very next day, they had a breast cancer patient, and they tried exposing. They actually brought the patient down to the Crookes tube factory, and they treated her tumor with X-rays. It turns out they gave her 18 treatments, and her tumor shrunk. Well, you can imagine what a sensation this was at this time. We're talking 1896. There were no treatments for cancer other than terribly disfiguring surgeries. So this was absolutely amazing. And doctors from all over the city started sending patients to this medical student who was working out of a Crookes tube factory. And from there, it spread around the world, and pretty soon doctors all over were starting to treat cancers with X-rays, not knowing exactly how they worked, only that knowing that they did, in fact, shrink tumors. And so from the time X-rays were discovered to the time the first patient was treated was just 30 days. That's how rapidly this technology got into the clinic. It's something that you could scarcely see today, that anything would move from bench to bedside that quickly.
And at what point was there an awareness that with radiation therapy that there was a risk involved, maybe not an enormous one if it was balanced against the fact that there were no cancer treatments at the time, but that there was a risk involved in using radiation as a therapy for cancer?
Well, as I said, it was... For the people who use it on a day-to-day basis, they knew that there were risks of burning themselves and also risk of hurting the patients. And it wasn't long before they started constructing shields that shielded normal tissue so that only the tumor area would be exposed. They would make these out of, like, lead foils and things like that to protect the patients. So the idea was to concentrate the radiation in the tumor where you could see the beneficial effect and not irradiate anything that wasn't going to benefit from the radiation, namely the normal tissue. But in terms of the patients, the primary risk to the patient was that they were going to die from the tumor that they had now. They weren't too much concerned about skin burns, which were being treated with petroleum jelly, and the risk of getting a cancer in the future, because their immediate concern was the cancer that they had now. So from their standpoint, the risks were worth, the benefits far outweighed the risk. In terms of the workers, there was a doctor and a dentist up in Boston who made extensive studies into how to limit the the exposure of workers to radiation, and they made like a box with a shutter on it so that the X-rays wouldn't irradiate everyone in the room. They were careful to stand far away from the X-ray tube when it was turned on, and they actually published a book that sold out immediately and was in multiple editions that went around the world to all the people that were using X-rays, mostly doctors and dentists at the time, telling them about the safe use of X-rays. You know, not everybody heeded this advice. You know, these two brothers actually lived well into their 80s, even though they worked with X-rays their whole lives. But others had had some terrible consequences. Dentists, in particular, many of them lost tips of their fingers because they would actually hold the X-ray films in the patient's mouth every time they took an X-ray. So every X-ray they took, they exposed their finger. So this was unwise, and many of them paid for it by having finger amputations and other unpleasant things like that. So people were aware that there were dangers. There were methods to protect people, particularly workers, but not everybody took those precautions, and some suffered the consequences of that.
Well, the question of risk is one of the themes of your book, Strange Glow, and one group of people was particularly aware of the risks because they were scientists who had seen earlier generations of radiation scientists get ill from exposure to radiation. And that is the scientists who were involved in the Manhattan Project put together by the United States to produce the first atomic bomb. And in their case, of course, we're talking about potentially very large doses of radiation. Can you tell us about the concerns that those scientists had as they were working to develop the U.S. bomb?
Yeah, so they had big concerns. And you're right. They had seen the older generation of scientists, some of whom were careless with radiation, suffer the consequences of exposure. And they were worried because there were two things going on. First of all, the atomic bomb scientists were working with concentrations of radioactivity that were unprecedented. And the other thing is they were working with types of radioisotopes that were previously unknown. So they had the double worry here. Suppose these new isotopes have new effects, and suppose these high concentrations of radioactivity give us whopping doses. And so there was something within the Manhattan Project called the Chicago Health Division that was responsible for protecting the workers. And they didn't have a lot of understanding about how radiation affected health, and their general principle was that they were just going to keep doses as low as they possibly could. For radioisotopes, radioactivity, basically no internal exposure was considered acceptable, so they developed all types of ways to prevent people from eating it or breathing it. It was considered, their limit was zero on that. And for external exposure to radiation, which they couldn't make it zero, they tightly regulated it. Everybody had to wear two dosimeters, and they would always take the higher. A dosimeter is an instrument that you wear that measures your radiation dose. They make people wear two, and then they assume that the lower one was wrong and that the higher one was right. And when people started getting levels of dose that were of concern, they would rotate them off that job. So there was vigorous efforts to protect the workers, and largely because they didn't really understand what was going on. So nevertheless, there were some accidents, and criticality accidents. Criticality is when you have so much uranium in one place that it can cause a chain reaction. So that happened a couple of times, and that was accidents, and they were accidents that happened because people disregarded safety precautions, and those people were massively overdosed in these criticality accidents and ended up dying. So those were tragic things that happened during the course of Manhattan Projects. So it was a big concern, and a lot of effort was put to protect people.
And of course, the most tragic result of the Manhattan Project was eventually the development of the bombs that got dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so much of what has come to be understood about radiation and its effect on human health comes out of the follow-up to what happened to people who were the victims of those bombings. Can you tell us about what was ultimately learned, bearing in mind that what killed the most people initially was not the radiation, but the shock waves and the incendiary fires that came from these two nuclear bombs, and then radiation was then poisoned those who survived?
Yes, so the atomic bombs, of course, were an awful event that shocked the entire world. And we think atomic bomb, we think radiation, people were killed with radiation. But you're correct. You're absolutely correct. Most people died in those bombings from the percussive effects and the fire produced by the bombs. So 75-80% of the people that were killed by the atomic bombs were killed in that way, and that's the way conventional bombs kill, percussive effects and fires. It was only the people that escaped the percussive effects and fires that that were alive to suffer the radiation effects. And so since we have learned largely about the effects of the atomic bomb from those survivors, we tend to think of bombs killing with radiation. But we need to remember that these bombs primarily kill like all other bombs do by just blowing things apart. So this radiation was an added dimension that other bombs didn't have. People who were exposed to the radiation from the bomb, this was a rather unique situation, because here was the first time where we had large numbers of people that were exposed over their whole bodies to uniform doses of radiation. And the other thing about this is that we knew, we were later able to determine very precisely what the doses these people received were, because the radiation came from the center, ground zero spot, and it emanated out from there. And just as everyone knows where they were when the Twin Towers were attacked, 9/11, everybody knew who was in Hiroshima exactly where they were standing when the atomic bomb went off. And because they could relate that information to scientists, the scientists could calculate exactly what dose they received. So this, in the aftermath of the bombing, this provided an opportunity, a tragic opportunity, but an opportunity to determine what the risk levels were for any particular dose. And so since that time, since the 1940s up to till this present day, the survivors of the atomic bomb, and there still are many survivors of the atomic bomb, are being studied. They're being studied at a research center in Hiroshima, Japan, as to the health consequences. And so we've been following these people, and so we have people at all different doses, and we see what happens to them later in life. Primarily, the issue is an increased risk of cancer, and we can, because of these people, determine what the risk of cancer per unit dose is. So this is an amazing study. It's really unlike any other study that has happened in epidemiology. It's called a cohort study. It's a large ongoing cohort study, and we've gotten very accurate information about radiation risk from those studies. And now, today, instead of needing a wife or daughter standard that I mentioned earlier, or an erythema standard based on burning of hands, we have standards that are based on the risk levels that were calculated from the Hiroshima survivors. So we owe a debt of gratitude to these people who have been willing for their whole lives to come in on a regular basis to health clinics in Japan and allow scientists to study them in terms of the long-term consequences of radiation. They didn't have to do it. They're volunteers, and they've tremendously helped through their very unfortunate situation the rest of the world come up with standards for radiation protection.
Well, were there any surprises that were learned from the consequences for these survivors in terms of, I mean, obviously radiation kills people. Obviously, large doses of radiation elevates the risk of cancer. Lower doses may not elevate it to the same degree, although in terms of mutations, even low doses can lead to mutations.
Well, the biggest surprise at the time is now that we have so much focus on cancer, it may be hard to understand, but at that time, the focus on the health effects was not on cancer. The focus was on genetic effects. So people were aware because of Darwin and other works on mutagenesis that people could harbor mutations and pass them on to their progeny. And it was believed that radiation mutated the germ cells in the body, and therefore you could pass horrible mutations on to your children. And so people were most concerned about that. So the initial effort was to find these mutated children, because it was scary for people, because what this meant is that you didn't even have to be exposed to the radiation yourself. You just had to have the misfortune of marrying someone who was exposed to radiation and having children that were deformed because of their prior exposure. So that was the emphasis. So the surprising thing was that the Hiroshima bomb study didn't find mutants. They're still looking for them. They have not found these mutants. It turns out that the frequency of producing mutations like that transmissible mutations from generation to generation, is very, very low. What they did find were the cancers, and they found more cancers than they expected, and fewer or no genetic effects. And so the focus of the study changed over time to being more a cancer study than anything else. And also something that was not known at the time, but is now appreciated, is that all tissues of the body are considered to be at risk for cancer from radiation. And it wasn't clear at the time that all tissues were susceptible, but now we believe that all tissues are susceptible. So if they have received a dose, they are susceptible to cancer. So now the study has largely been determining the cancer risk for specific tissues, and less so for the genetics, because there hasn't been any genetic mutants found.
Molecular radiation biologist Timothy Jorgensen is my guest. We'll return with him in a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm talking to the author of Strange Glow, The Story of Radiation. His name is Timothy Jorgensen, and he's Associate Professor of Radiation Medicine and Director of the Health Physics and Radiation Protection Graduate Program at Georgetown University. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, another instance where, very sadly, human beings were, in effect, the guinea pigs for the effects of radiation, happened in the post-war era in the Pacific, with the United States testing the hydrogen bomb. Can you tell us what was learned from that sad experience in terms of the danger of fallout for the residents of the Marshall Islands and Bikini Atoll and other Pacific Islanders exposed to radioactive fallout?
Yeah, so fallout is when radioactivity mixes with dust particles in the sky, gets into clouds, and then largely settles back down to Earth. And so that's our definition of fallout. So you're being exposed to radioactivity that's coming down from the sky. So there was very little fallout in the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings. And the reason for this is that the bombs were detonated high above the ground. They were not detonated at ground level. And so since they were detonated in the sky, they did not kick up huge clouds of dust. And the radioactivity that was released largely just dissipated and blew out to sea and never came back down on the population. So the Hiroshima and Nagasaki situations are unique in that the people suffer just from the blast irradiation, the radiation coming from the bomb itself. But when bombs were tested later in primarily the Bikini Atolls, which are a chain of islands in the Marshall Islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, very isolated region, that's why it was chosen for atomic bomb testing. These bombs were tested at ground level. And they were also larger bombs, much larger bombs. And so they kicked up fallout into the sky. And even though they were aware of the possibility of that happening and had evacuated some islands, unfavorable weather conditions blew the fallout to areas that they beyond where they expected it to fall. And this is the first time that humans encountered people who had, mankind had encountered people who had been exposed to very high levels of fallout. And so we learned about fallout effects from those people, from the Marshall Islanders. And this is how we first learned about iodine-131. Iodine-131 fell down on these islanders. It got incorporated into the foods they eat, and so they got high doses of radiation to their thyroid, and consequently, they started coming down with thyroid cancers. There were also new compounds like strontium. It turns out that strontium behaves like radium chemically, and so strontium went to the bone, and many of those islanders suffered some of the same consequences that had been seen with the radium watch dial painters. So we learned a tremendous amount about fallout. So these people had not been exposed to the blast effects. They had just been exposed to the fallout. So this is another unique population that has been studied for many years for the consequences of fallout. And from them, we learned a lot about how radioactivity in the body behaves. And this is relevant even today because the types of radioisotopes that are released by nuclear bombs are similar to the types of radioisotopes that are produced in nuclear power plants. So if you have a nuclear power plant accident or leak, you're going to see the same types of radioisotopes, not at the same levels, hopefully, but the same types. And so we can determine from the Marshall Islanders what levels of radioactivity are expected to cause problems and what type of cancer levels to see and all that from the studies that were done in the Marshall Islands.
Well, so following up with that then, in 2011, there was the nuclear reactor meltdown in Fukushima in Japan. And the question of the consequences of that in some ways are still not entirely understood. But what has been identified in terms of the risk for people in Japan and in that in the immediate vicinity of the Fukushima reactor?
So Fukushima, as you know, resulted in reactor meltdowns and release of radioactivity into the environment. This is the second time we've seen something on that scale, and the first time was Chernobyl. So the information that we can get to inform us about health consequences in Japan is coming from first the Marshall Islanders, but secondarily from what we know happened in Chernobyl. The chief concern is cancer to the thyroid, because in Chernobyl we saw a significant amount of thyroid cancer, particularly for children. But the situation in Japan is quite different. First of all, the Chernobyl accident was much, much larger than the Fukushima accident. So much, much more radioactivity was released into the environment. The second thing is that people were not told in Chernobyl, what was going on. And so they there was a period of time where people were eating and drinking and consuming locally grown produce and other foodstuffs, and were exposing themselves before they even knew what was going on. And the other thing about the people in Chernobyl is they had iodine-deficient diets, which meant that their thyroids were absolutely starved for iodine. So this was the triple whammy, okay? Very, very large amounts of radioactivity released to the environment, continuing to eat foodstuffs in the local area, and having thyroids that were starved for iodine. So that largely, those things together contributed to a significant increase in thyroid cancer to the Chernobyl people.
You mentioned with Chernobyl that people continued to eat local produce versus in Fukushima. How long is local produce contaminated? You write in the book specifically about dairy products and how dairy tends to accumulate dangerous substances.
Yeah, so the dairy is a concern for the iodine-131. So iodine-131 has a half-life of 8 days. So the reason it's a concern is because it comes down to the ground as fallout. It gets incorporated into grass. The grass gets eaten by cows. It gets into the milk, and it ends up in dairy products. So the good thing about the iodine-131, it has a half-life of 8 days, which means that every 8 days there's only half as much as there was before. So if you carry this out to, 5-6 half-lives, you can see that in a couple of months, virtually all of it is gone. So if you can keep people from eating the local dairy products primarily, but other produce as well, for a period of a couple of months, basically that problem has solved itself because the radioactivity has all decayed away. So there's no longer any threat from iodine-131 from the Fukushima accident. All of that radioactivity is long gone.
Well, let me end by asking you where we should be concerned in terms of risk, because what you've basically been arguing, and you argue in Strange Glow, is that radiation has risks. Radiation is also with us in terms of X-rays are going to continue in our lives. One can have debates clearly about nuclear power, and with Donald Trump, perhaps that's going to increase, but that radiation, whatever its dangers, isn't something that's just going to disappear, and that we as lay people should are capable of making assessments about risk and exposure and the degree to which we elect or don't elect to be exposed. Obviously, being next to a nuclear power plant that melts down, we don't have much choice over that. But more broadly speaking, there are some decisions that we can make. So bearing that in mind, and if you can answer in as briefly as possible with this large question, where are the risks that we should be concerned with?
Okay, so I've been a little more opinionated in this radio interview than I am in the book, actually. In the book takes a slightly different angle on things. It tries to describe radiation, what it does, what its health consequences are, and also to measure and quantify both the risks and the benefits. And it leaves to the reader to decide which risks they want to worry about and which they don't. So the problem is that everybody's risk tolerance is not the same. So what's acceptable to one person may be totally unacceptable to another. So it doesn't really work telling people this you should worry about and this you shouldn't. They have to decide that for themselves. And so that's the approach I've taken in the book, try to explain how these risks are calculated, what the risk levels are, what the benefits are, and let people decide on an individual basis. So one of the things that I delve into in the book in terms of things that might be riskier than people had thought, for example, are I talk about diagnostic radiography, and there's two different worlds of diagnostic radiography. There's one where people come in and they have a suspect disease and they're using an X-ray or some other radiation technology to find out what's wrong with them. And in those cases, the benefits are very high, and the risks are usually extremely low. But in other cases, we talk about the worried well. they might subscribe to some of these commercial endeavors. You don't really see this too much in academic medical centers, but you do see it in private facilities where you get a whole body scan. When you're absolutely, they're screening for a disease from, so they'll give you an entire body scan from head to toe with a spiral CT scan device looking for disease. Well, the person came in with no symptoms of disease. You've scanned their whole body. Their whole body has now gotten a dose of radiation, and there's no proven benefit from doing this. So I think that consumers need to think about some of these issues going in and make individual decisions whether they want to subject themselves to such whole body screening when they don't have any other symptoms of disease, or whether they want to use radiation more judiciously to find the cause of disease that they have symptoms with. And so that would be my recommendation to people. Understand the risks going in and make a decision for yourself whether you want to have that procedure, whether you want to live next to a nuclear power plant, whether you want to worry about nuclear bombs, whether you want to worry about the radioactivity in the food you eat. Understand what the risks are and make your own decision.
I've been speaking with Timothy Jorgensen. He is a molecular radiation biologist based at Georgetown University, author of Strange Glow, The Story of Radiation, which is published by Princeton University Press. Timothy, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, Sasha.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.